Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. The whole team is together. We're excited to have everybody back here. I've got my three compadres, Wade McFall or Wade McFowl, depending upon what part of the country you're from and who you're talking to, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA field office of the OIG, and now a member of our SIU investigative team, Matt Kachansky, retired executive from HHS OIG, the former Northeast UPIC director and one of the managers on our investigative team, and Jason Eisengrind, who was really Matt's counterpart, executive over at HHS OIG, retired from there, went on to be the Western UPIC director, and is now a special director in charge, special projects and process improvement. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse. And I just always want to preface, sometimes I don't say it enough, but the value of having people with this background really does make a differentiator when we're having these kind of conversations. And also when we're talking to some of our clients, the fact that we have people that worked at the OIG and understand the inside workings of criminal, civil, and administrative proceedings from the investigative side, but then also having people like Matt and Jason who are intrinsically involved with CMS and ran the SIU of Medicare, so to speak, to understand that really does help to provide some clarity and some back-end story on things that the general public may not fully understand or be able to comprehend at the time. So with that, I want to start by talking about, we're going to spend our time talking about, there's a breach that occurred that's been in the news, the largest breach in history, in the healthcare space, at least. It has now been going on for a little over a week. There's some news reports that the class action lawsuits are starting or are going to start regarding this breach, and the dollar values are really hitting into the hundreds of millions of dollars on the provider side from claims not being able to be processed and the like. And for those of you that are keeping up on this, you know that this breach that occurred involved a company that is involved with processing the lion's share of claims around the country. I've even seen some articles where some of the plans are talking about having providers go back and submit paper claims so that those claims can continue to be processed. So the collateral effects of this are going to be very broad and very long-standing. But the big question is, outside of that breach and outside of the issues involving a breach, which occur pretty frequently, as we know, there are going to be a ton of fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues that are going to be relative to that. So, Wade, I want to start with you, because the very first thing that comes to mind, at least from our perspective, is when there's a breach and information is stolen, it's stolen for the purposes of mostly identity theft and all of the collateral things that go on with identity theft. And, you were working identity theft cases out of LA at a time when I think it wasn't really very prevalent for a lot of other regions around the country to work on them. I know in New York, we worked on a handful of cases that involved identity theft, not from breaches. We worked on one where some organized crime groups that were looking to do some fraudulent DME stuff, they were actually bribing the records clerk of hospitals, right? So these are low paid people that work in a basement room for 8 hours a day and they see no windows or anything. And somebody comes and offers them $10 for every face sheet that they, can produce. And these people are just, churning them out. But you were working on these identity theft cases back, years ago and continued to work on them for many years. And that is the number one concern, right? And the collateral effects of stealing one's identity for the purposes of false claims and false submission of claims for reimbursement.
Yeah, that's true. But in Los Angeles, much like you were saying, the identity theft wasn't necessarily a result of a breach. It was more, as you said, it's like buying patient lists, or you had clinic administrators or clinic managers that would get patient lists. And a lot of times they were from marketers and cappers who would, approach Medicare beneficiaries. We could do a whole nother podcast on that. But what they would have these, they'd have, Medicare beneficiaries, Social Security numbers, Medicare numbers. And basically they would end up using those just to bill for services not rendered claims. And what would happen in most of the times in Los Angeles, we had these clinics where the managers were running it. They had physicians that they kind of controlled at these small, inner city clinics that weren't probably weren't the best healthcare in Los Angeles, but they controlled the physician who worked there. And we had we had one consensual monitoring situation where one of the clinic administrators who was kind of involved in organized crime in the Glendale area, but he explained it to our CI. And at the time, I think it was kind of enlightening. We kind of knew that this kind of thing was going on, but we didn't have it explained to this extent. So we would go to different locations. This was another issue we talked about before, the change of ownerships, where you go to a clinic, we're seeing all these bad claims. We go there and the doctor's not there. There's maybe one person sitting there, or in most cases, it's just like an abandoned suite. So we're trying to figure out how this happened. And we eventually came across an informant who was a career criminal, and he knew a lot of people in the business. But these people approached him with Medicare checks. This was before everything was, you know, electronically paid. He had Medicare checks that these clinic managers were trying to launder, basically. And we were kind of confused at first, and we worked it with ICE. ICE, Customs and Immigration, discovered this. They didn't know what was going on with the checks, so they brought us in on board. And basically what was happening, and they explained this in one of the meetings, but they would have the one clinic where they're working with the physician. They would take his information, do a change of ownership, get another clinic that the physician didn't know about. And the administrator explained it to our CI, who was good at acting dumb. He's like, I don't understand what you guys are doing, why you need these checks cleaned, and why don't you just have the doctor do it? And they explained to him in simple layman's terms that we have the doctor here at, you know, location A, we control him, he knows what's going on, he sees some patients, but we have all of his information. So we take it and we go to location B, and we think it's best that he doesn't know about it, because if the feds come talking to him and asking him questions, he can't say anything because he doesn't know about it. Location A, he's aware of, you know, we keep that relatively clean. Location B, they'd hit it hard. If we would come and talk to the doctor about all these false claims, he doesn't know about it, and so he can't tell us anything. So that consensual monitoring, where they explained it to one of the clinic managers, was kind of, we kind of knew what was going on, but it was pretty enlightening because we hadn't really heard it from the horse's mouth. So it was kind of an interesting transition for us.
You know, and in today's climate, where it's a little bit more, you know, everything is electronic, right? Payments are electronic, all that. You know, the one thing that we see, you know, one of the biggest areas of fraud right now, kind of in the general sense, is all of the telemed related frauds, right? So, you know, COVID did some positive things in forcing the healthcare system in this country to move towards that modernization of electronic mediums and things of that sort. But, you know, no good deed goes unpunished, right? So prior to COVID, in the telemedicine space, the only time that Medicare paid for telemedicine visits had to do with site of origin and, you know, generally speaking, for things like remote cardiac consultations and things of that sort. It was very limited, and it had to do with what they call MSAs, the metropolitan statistical areas and the like. Whereas now, telemedicine is a commonplace thing. But as a result of that uptick in that telemedicine related stuff is also now this unbelievable explosion of the DME frauds, right? And the genetic testing frauds and all of those collateral things, and the true lack of a doctor-patient relationship that becomes very evident as a result that there not being a collateral E&M for the patient that is getting that DME. And so you get the good with the bad. And, you know, in the modern world, you know, you see this. So, Jason, I want to go to you because, you know, part of this then becomes on the payer side, and, you know, always going to be on the provider side, is going to be having robust security measures. And unfortunately, those things come with a cost, right? It's very expensive. And so you've got to be able to balance your ability to have a proper set of security protocols in place, right? So the common one in the healthcare space is something called HITRUST. Advise just got HITRUST certified at the end of February. It is a long, arduous, expensive process, to get that. All of the payers are HITRUST certified. The payers, in fact, I think work very symbiotically in this regard to get the parameters set up on what HITRUST is going to look like. But from a policy, from a process perspective, you've got to have this insurance. It comes with a cost. And then as a result of those things, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? Because now you've got potentially the inability to fully staff an SIU or payment integrity or something else. We see right now some of the large payers out there are doing massive layoffs of staff, even when they're having record profits. But there's this, and I use this term unfortunately quite freely, is this push-pull of, it's like when you take macroeconomics and the professor talks about guns and butter, right? Guns, the things that the government needs to operate, and butter, the things that people want. And I think you get that same kind of push-pull in the payer community on what's needed, what do you want, and how do we make do with all of these things, particularly in the sense of a breach, because then we're going to talk in a minute with Matt about profiting from the chaos.
So, yeah, the cost of doing something versus the cost of not doing something, it's hard to quantify, but it's a really important analysis. So, if you aren't properly insured, if you don't have proper security measures in place, which in of themselves are costly features, but without them, you're talking about probably bankrupting the company in a serious cyber breach. So, hope can't be the plan. It needs to be a strategic decision about how to spend the organization's money and protect it from those types of activities.
And Wade, before I go to Matt, I just want to go back to you because we were talking before we started this recording about some of the estimates of the losses that are resulting from this breach and how those losses are comparing to the NHCAA studies, right? So you did a little bit of research to identify that how big this breach really could be.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different figures out there, but NHCAA, a lot of times they'll say that they think that the fraud loss amount per year is somewhere between 3 and 10%, which equates to like tens of billions up to $306 billion in loss. And there's estimates on this cyber attack that we're talking fraud. NHCAA is talking more fraud loss. This cyber attack is talking more about just loss due to the disruption, but they're saying that they're up to $100 million a day now. And if you do the kind of easy math, that's $36.5 billion, I think it is. It's basically commensurate with the loss throughout the whole year that NHCAA is estimating. Now, granted, we don't expect these losses due to this breach of $100 million a day to continue for a year. They think they'll get a handle on it sometime towards the end of March. But as far as like a daily rate, this breach is costing in loss, as opposed to, we're kind of doing apples and oranges here, but loss as opposed to fraud, but at the same basically dollar amount per day of somewhere around $100 million. And this is just for like seven companies.
Right. So yeah. So what we're really talking about is regardless of how you do the actual math, at the end of the day, it is very possible that this breach, from a combination of things, could wind up equating to that 3 to 10% of the fraud. And by the way, for those that are keeping track of these kind of studies and read them, these estimations that come out of the NHCAA, National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association, the FBI, I think, has done some studies. This 3 to 10% estimate is really an estimate just based upon frauds that we kind of know about, right? It doesn't even include things that we have no idea about. But yeah, the $100 million number or more is going to wind up being the result of, it's a combination of things, right? It's business losses, it's things of that sort. So Matt, I want to go to you because we talked a little bit about this and you talked about the profit out of chaos and the fact that there is going to be, These breaches are for one purpose only, and that's to wreak havoc on whatever the systems are that they're taking that information for, right? It's not like we're talking about, a breach of a government agency where a foreign adversary is monitoring activities for 5 years for intelligence purposes and things of that sort. A breach in the healthcare space is really primarily for the purpose of being able to steal identities, to then put that information on the deep web for profit, and to then get involved with these, you know, systemic frauds involving the telemedicine, the DME, because we see constantly these situations where the beneficiaries, the members, they get a piece of DME, they get medication through the mail, they get a genetic test in the mail, and they have no idea. You know, I don't know who this doctor is or whatever, but you use that term profit and chaos because then you get into all these collateral things that, you know, involve these other fraud schemes, involve the ransomwares and the things of that sort.
Yeah. And it's not just related to breaches, as you said. Go back to COVID, you know, when that hit, that was chaos because no one knew how to handle a new way of doing business in the healthcare industry. So they created all sorts of things to try to, you know, provide help to people, the PPE loans, the things like that, where let's get the money out to the folks that need it as quickly as they can. That's opportunity for fraudsters. In this breach, one of the things they're doing is creating grants and loans for providers that probably do need these bridge loans, but there's going to be some that don't, that are going to take advantage of that and get into, you know, how do I get into this system and steal these funds that are now readily available because of the chaos caused by this ransomware attack. Another right. aspect is when COVID hit, there were a lot of waivers put in place on the guardrails, on the FWA guardrails in the healthcare system. They waived a lot of those things. And so opportunists took advantage of that, such as, you know, DME, when they waived all of the enrollment, you know, guidelines, 4,000 new DME companies open up in Miami in a month. You know, those types of things are going to happen here too. And the way the UPIX fought against that is we created models that mirrored data models that mirrored what those waivers were. If these waivers take effect, what should we be seeing in the data? What would be aberrant in the data? And we looked for those aberrancies in the data, whether it was spikes in certain, you know, COVID testing and different patterns in that. And we were catching things as it happened. You know, again, pay and chase, but still we were able to catch those things. The same things are going to have to happen here based on these breaches. You know, what was compromised, what wasn't? Do we need to look for changes of addresses? Do we need to look for spikes in specific providers' billings, you know, from different locations? And you have to look for those things and create models that are going to catch those things. So there's going to be long-term impact, even though they might fix the breach, but there's still going to be long-term unknown impacts based on what has occurred. And I'll give a little cautionary tale. You talked about the, you know, the sponsored government, you know, infiltrations of things. I worked at NASA for 8 years, and, you know, we had the most sensitive data in the world in terms of propulsion data. All of our rocket engineering stuff was all very secure, the most secure system in the world. It got hacked every day. It was hacked by government-sponsored, government-supported, government-acknowledged hackers that were trying to beat us in the space race. Truckloads, literally, every day being hacked. And as quickly as we could react, you know, with, you know, within the system and then bringing in whoever to fix these breaches and to find out what happened, you never know how deep they've gone. You never know what types of things they've left behind. So there's going to be larger right. impact from these things that even we don't know about right now.
You know, and you know, the challenge with a lot of this is that when these breaches occur, they're occurring overseas by foreign entities. They're not onshore. You know, the one thing I think a lot of people don't know and it's not that it's a secret, people just don't know it, is that within the OIG, within our old shop, Office of Investigations, is a computer crimes unit that is made up of a handful of agents who are very specially trained in computer IT security and breaches and all that. And they do all of the, you know, sort of the forensic pieces, not computer forensics that we would traditionally think of imaging a computer and recovering, but it's, you know, tracing all of these things. And I remember that, you know, the issue that it existed for a long time was that not a single one of the cases that those agents worked on ever came to fruition, because they would ultimately trace it back to a hacker in a foreign country where there was no jurisdiction, you know, typically state-sponsored, you know, Eastern, you know, Eastern part of the world. So that becomes a challenge, that when you do go and identify who these bad actors may be, they're not people that you can get access to and bring to justice. So oftentimes these breaches go unpunished. So there is no ability to do anything from a deterrent perspective. But I do think that what we're going to see, and I think this is what we're all really talking about, is that while this breach is pretty broad, it really did affect a large payer community, because a lot of plans process their claims through this one particular company. So it's going to have a lot of collateral effects. And I think it's just going to be a matter of time until we start to see some of the residual, right? With COVID, we didn't really understand what the fraud, waste, abuse issues were with COVID until probably, you know, a year or two into it. I think that there's going to be some really long-lasting implications from this breach, considering how big it was from the fraud, waste, abuse perspective. But also, I think we're going to have to figure out at some point what are the collateral costs, right? You see now hospitals are having cash flow issues, providers having cash flow issues, and it really is going to be almost like the commercial version of PPP loans, right? Providers are going to have to do something to get something back from the plans. The big question is going to be from a fraud, waste, abuse perspective, and Matt, I want to give you the last laugh on this, so to speak, is going to be that, you know, these things are going to create opportunities. Providers that may be on the cusp of fraud, who are not getting paid, are now maybe pissed off and mad about it, right? And so they're going to say, I need to get my money somehow. And so there's going to be that prospect of providers engaging in the traditional claims fraud, because they are reacting collaterally to something that they have no involvement with.
Right. The motivation of seeing these things happen, I'm not making the money I even think I should be initially. Now I'm not making anything because the place isn't secure enough to protect my information. I'm going to take advantage of that. I'm going to say, you know, I've got to assure my own income here. And so I've been towing the line. Now I'm going to step over a little bit, you know, that, and since they're going to be focused on, you know, their efforts on fixing this breach and doing all that, maybe they're not going to see me. You know, they're not going to see these little things when their eyes are focused on something else.
Right. It's almost like what I suffer, shiny object syndrome, right? You're busy looking at this. You're not realizing about what that is. And that becomes an important piece of it. And Wade, you brought up, you know, this whole premise of this change of ownership and all of that, that, you know, as a result of there being all of these, this breach and all this information that's out there, does CMS now need to start looking a little bit more carefully at things like an uptick in change of ownership and things of that sort, the creation of shell companies? Now, obviously, we've got some new statutes that were put in place. The most recent one is the Corporate Transparency Act that took place this year. We've blogged about it. We've done a podcast about it. We've spoken about it. But, you know, that's going to be a piece of that puzzle, how CHOWs or change of ownerships are going to come through. And then, you know, really, the CMS platform of APS, Advanced Provider Screening, is there going to have to be an uptick in some of the enforcement monitoring that comes about as a result of that? So it's a to be continued, right? We're still, you know, they're talking about the fact that the things may start come online at the end of this week or next week. And I think, you know, as everything else, the fraud tends to be a little delayed. But I think in 6 months or a year from now, we're going to start seeing instances where fraudulent claims are being submitted as a result of information that has been stolen from this breach and ended up on the deep web. So it's definitely going to be in a plan's best interest to start doing some deep web monitoring and identify instances where there where those breaches have become compromised, right? CMS may have to start looking at its MBIs, right? The Medicare beneficiary identifiers. Those numbers were put in place a few years ago to replace the HIC numbers, the health insurance claim numbers, because a HIC number was tied to a social security number. So, you know, is there going to be a protocol in place to start reissuing MBI numbers if a number, if the identity of a Medicare beneficiary that went through any of this was processed? So, to be continued, right? A lot of predictive modeling is probably going on right now. So we'll see. Stay tuned, I think, is going to be really the answer. As always, it's great talking to you guys. And as always, we appreciate people who tune into the podcast. And again, if you're not getting our newsletter, you can get it by reaching out to us at hello@advisehealth.com. You can catch our newsletter every Friday. It comes right to your inbox. You'll get to see our four smiling and shining faces every week in your inbox as part of our OIG roundtable. You can always catch them on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube, search for Advise Health, and you can find that, subscribe to that. And also, we've got some great LinkedIn Lives coming up. For those of you that joined our LinkedIn Live just this past other day, where we talked about the art of negotiation, that was one of our most highly sought and attended LinkedIn Lives. We've got a great one coming up in April. We're going to be talking about the case of U.S. versus Dr. Richard Paulus, which was out of Eastern District of Kentucky. I will be speaking to the two lawyers that that worked on the defense of that case. I was involved with that case from the advice side, so we're going to be doing that. We've got a whole bunch of other LinkedIn Lives that are lined up. So we've got a lot of good content coming. And again, we appreciate everybody for participating and following us. Again, you can catch us on LinkedIn, follow us on LinkedIn, join the group of people that are following us for additional content as well. So as always, it's good spending the time with you guys, and we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.
Thank you all.
Thank you.